Pretty cool. I have a T-shirt that I like that I got recently. Jody hates it, but it says because it's what I want this message this to be my message. It says Longview doesn't suck. I love it. It's a great T-shirt. Longview doesn't suck. The part she doesn't like is right below that where it says you do. But it's really for the people who think Longview sucks. That's what that part is for. So if you want them, they're at Bigfoot T-shirts down on Commerce. They're making them down there, and you can go buy one. But I just thought, I want to promote that message. There's so many people think that Longview sucks. Longview doesn't suck. Longview is a place where people like Don get healed. Yeah. I mean, let's keep this going. So let's go to the text for today, Luke chapter 6, verses 1 through 11. And this is a continuing story, obviously. One Sabbath day, as Jesus was walking through some grain fields, his disciples broke off heads of grain, rubbed off the husk in their hands, and ate the grain. But some Pharisees said, "Why are you breaking the law by harvesting grain on the Sabbath?" Jesus replied, "Haven't you read in the scriptures what David did when he and his companions were hungry? They went into the house of God and broke the law by eating the sacred loaves of bread that only the priests can eat. He also gave some to his companions." And Jesus added, "The Son of Man is Lord, even over the Sabbath." On another Sabbath day, a man with a deformed right hand was in the synagogue with Jesus was teaching. The teachers of the religious law and the Pharisees watched Jesus closely. If he healed that man's hand, they planned to accuse him of working on the Sabbath. But Jesus knew their thoughts. He said to the man with the deformed hand, "Come and stand in front of everyone." So the man came forward. Then Jesus said to his critics, "I have a question for you. Does the law permit good deeds on the Sabbath, or is it a day for doing evil?" "Is this a day to save life or to destroy it?" He looked around at them one by one and said to the man, "Hold out your hand." So the man held out his hand, and it was restored. At this, the enemies of Jesus were wild with rage and began to discuss what to do with him. So today's we are in this series called Road Trip with Jesus, and the whole point is, if you were hanging out with Jesus in Galilee during this period of time, again, this is about a year into his ministry. He's already been doing ministry for a year. He's in the area of Galilee, which is an area at the top of the Dead Sea, just to the west of there, and it's just a geographic area where he spent quite a bit of time. And Luke chapters 5 through 14 are about that period of time in the Galilee. And so that's the period we're looking at. And we're just looking to think, to see what would we have learned if we would have been with Jesus during that time. The battleground for today is the Sabbath, but that's not the battle that's going on. The battle that's going on is over legalism and religion, being religious, a religious spirit. That's the battle that's going on. But it's in the battlefield called the Sabbath. And so you can easily be distracted by that and really not see the power of what's going on by thinking that this is just an argument between the Pharisees and Jesus over the Sabbath. This is really about legalism and the legalistic nature of the people who were leaders at that time. People who knew the law better than anyone else. And even though they knew the law, they started to add rules to the law outside of what it says in the Bible, outside of what it says historically. They started to add rules that separated them. Remember last time we talked about the separation that they brought, that separated them from the rest of the people. They were on one level of spiritual authority and everybody else was on another. And that's what those rules did. The Sabbath was God's idea. Let's just talk about the Sabbath for a sec. The Sabbath was God's idea. And you can read about that in Exodus chapter 20. It was his idea. He came up with it. It wasn't man's idea. He said this: "Remember to observe the Sabbath day by keeping it holy. You have 6 days each week for your ordinary work, but the seventh is the Sabbath day of rest dedicated to the Lord your God. On that day, no one in your household may do work. This includes you, your sons and daughters, your male and female servants, your livestock, any foreigners that live among you. For 6 days the Lord made the heavens and the earth and the sea and everything in them, but on the seventh day he rested. That is why the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and set it apart. Just a sec here. So this whole idea of the Sabbath was God's, and it was, I don't think that people really clearly understood what was going on with the Sabbath. It was a religious time that was set apart, but it was also something that was really important to God himself. So God's not just the God of the Sabbath, but he's the God of creation, right? He's God of all creation. And if you look at the creation story in Genesis chapter 1 and chapter 2, he starts out creating, and God creates first the watery formless earth. It's suspended in darkness and void of space. There's no sun or any other stars, no moon or no planets except for the earth, and God creates light. That's the first. Day one, he creates light, and then he separates the light from the darkness. Day two, he forms the earth's atmosphere, separating the water into two parts. Then on day three, he creates the dry land and oceans. I mean, he's busy. He's been doing a lot these first couple days. On day three, he creates the dry land and oceans. He creates the vegetation, the seed-bearing plants. He probably created the Garden of Eden on the third day. On the fourth day, he created the sun and the moon. So up to the third day, there were no sun and moon, but he created light. So light doesn't come from the sun. Light comes from God. He created light before he even created sun. So the sun, which we think we kind of worship as being the whole source of our light, you know, like a couple weeks ago, the sun disappeared for a few seconds. And we were like, oh, this is amazing, this is amazing. And everybody's running to Central Oregon or to Salem or to the coast to see the sun disappear. The reality is, the light is not the sun. The light is Jesus. And the light was created before the sun. I just think that's crazy cool. The light was created before the sun. The sun and the moon were created, and the stars and other planets were created on day four. On day five, the water creatures of all kinds were created. The birds were created. Day six, the land animals were created. At this point, they were all vegetarian. They didn't eat each other. So, you know, that's just the way they were created. And on day six, man was created, and he was a vegetarian as well. And then woman, Eve, was created on day six as well. So on all the animals, and Adam and Eve were all created on day six. Actually, Eve wasn't created. She was taken out of the rib of Adam and formed. So at the end of day six, God's got the earth, the sun, the moon, the stars, all the animals, man, all done. And he's created it all. And you know what his first thing that he does after? I think I shared this a while back. I love this. I love this perspective. The first thing he does after he finishes creating everything, the first thing he does is he turns to Adam and says, Adam? And Adam says, yeah, Lord. He says, you know what I'm going to do today, the seventh day? I'm going to take the day off and spend it with you. And he spends the whole day with what he created, with the one he created. It wasn't a religious thing. It's like, and he wasn't tired. He wasn't taking a day off because he was tired. He was stopping everything because he wanted to enjoy his creation. He wanted to enjoy man. He wanted to enjoy Adam and Eve. He wanted to enjoy the creation. And so the Sabbath is a different thing than really what we think. We think it's a religious rule and law. You can't do anything on the Sabbath. And we would make a list, and the it says don't work on the Sabbath in the law, God's law, the Torah. It says don't work on the Sabbath. Well, the Pharisees made 39 more rules that explained how they can't work. It's just crazy what they did. And so what this whole battleground of the Sabbath was a battleground that really came from God. He spelled out how the Sabbath worked. You know, it's interesting. In the Old Testament, the Sabbath was on Saturday, right? Then Jesus rose from the dead on Sunday, right? Constantine, who was the leader of Rome in the early 300s, apparently experienced a conversion of some kind. People will argue whether it was a true conversion or whether it was for political reasons. But he was the head of Rome, and he became a Christian. And he really he made Christianity at the end of his reign. After he was out of power, they made Christianity the main religion of the Roman Empire. By one man becoming a Christian. By one man turning his heart to God. Turning his heart and giving his heart to God. So then along comes America, and we've got the Jewish Sabbath on Saturday, we've got the Christian Sabbath on Sunday, and instantly we have weekends. Because we've embraced both Sabbaths. I mean, there's stories about it being having an agricultural basis for weekends, but really the reality is the weekends came to being because of the Jewish and the Christian Sabbath being combined together and honoring both those Sabbaths. So a Sabbath has always been something that's important to us. But the real battle here is over legalism. The real battle here is over religiousness, religiosity, religious heart. And it's not, and I'll use those terms the same. Religion and legalism are pretty much the same thing. But the legalists were the ones who were confronting Jesus. And there are two groups, and you can read about it a couple verses down as we read through the story. The scribes are one group, and the Pharisees are the other. This is another thing I've just learned this last week as I was studying this a little bit more. The scribes were really the powerful leaders. I always thought the Pharisees were the powerful leaders, and the scribes took notes. Actually, that's not true. The scribes had to be 40 years old. They had to be professionally trained. They had to study under someone else. They knew the scriptures in and out. The scribes were powerful in that whole religious system. And so I heard one teacher describe it as they were the queen bee. The scribes were the queen bees. And then the Pharisees were not necessarily trained by someone else, not necessarily have sat under someone else. Paul sat under Gamaliel, who was his mentor, but you didn't have to necessarily be under someone else. But they learned from the scribes. And so this guy that I was listening to described them as the swarm. And the Pharisees all had a scribe that they worked with, all had a scribe that they learned from. And the scribes would send the Pharisees out to make sure people were obeying the laws that the scribes wrote. The scribes set in place. And so they would go and they would swarm over this group of people and they would swarm over this group of people. And when they would swarm over a group of people, they would antagonize them and they would push them and they would push the rules. And they were really powerful. They could really make your life miserable if you disobeyed what they said. And so they were kind of the implementers of the law, the implementers of the rule. They were kind of like the blue-collar religious leaders who weren't necessarily formally educated, but they would swarm over people and they would criticize them and they would really attempt to get them to either obey what the rules that the Pharisees, the scribes had set in place, or, you know, they would be thrown into jail or something like that, be punished some way. And this whole idea of legalism is, I mean, I've never been in a church that was legalistic. I don't think. I mean, there's always a little bit of manipulation in every church because there's an agenda and the leaders want to get the agenda promoted and moving forward. And so there's always a little bit of rules that you have to follow to fit in. Like if somebody came in here in a suit and a tie, they would feel out of place. The first thing that people would do is look at them and go, "What are they doing here? Don't they know we dress casually? Don't they know that we don't have much structure?" You know, and so anything can be religious-like, you know, but you don't have to go back to the first century church to find religion and legalism. There was a group, and it really happened in the late 70s, and I think it all was in response to the Jesus People movement. You know, that's when a lot of the hippies got saved, and all of a sudden this huge influx of people came into the church. And it actually became a movement, and lots of people came into the church. They were not trained. They didn't know the Bible. They accepted it really quickly and then started to learn as fast as they could. But these people, because there was a void, were put into positions of leadership pretty quickly. And yet they didn't have much biblical base to them. And it was really a problem. And so I think that some of this was a response to that. But a group of five men in Fort Lauderdale in the early 80s got together and said, "We want to create a system of accountability for this movement that's going on, for all the people who are immature." And so they became a group of guys who were accountable to each other. And under each of them, they had five guys that were accountable to each other and so on and so forth. And it spread really quickly because there was a huge need for that in the Christian world. And there was a church in town. Some of us were part of that church. There was a church in town that embraced this whole idea. It was called the Shepherding Movement. And the whole idea was that there was spiritual authority that worked from the top down, and it provided some construct for living life. And so you would confer with the people that were in you, that were leaders over you, and you would run things by them if you were going to make big decisions about buying a house or buying a car or something like that. Well, it got, as it does, twisted really quickly. Because anytime you give a group of people spiritual authority, that spiritual authority can be abused. And that's what we see happening here. And honestly, we have a neighbor. Her and her husband were part of that group, part of one of those small groups, part of that whole system, and they left the church at that point, and they've never been back. It's been 40 years, and they've never been back to church since because they were so wounded and hurt by it. Because once you experience manipulation of that kind at that level, it's just hard to trust people anymore. Because once you get burned by people, and a lot of you have been burned by leaders, by Christian leaders. And I just have to say, you know, I'm sorry that you got hurt. On the other hand, you've probably hurt people too, you know? I'm really, really quick to back off of being too aggressive in punishing people for some of the stuff they've done in the past, because I've probably done some of that stuff myself. I mean, because we all have agendas, and we all think we know what God wants. And I'm always a little wary when somebody comes up to me and says, I think we should do this. And what they're really saying is, I think you should do this, and I'll watch, you know, and I'll judge you, and I'll make sure you're doing it right. But what they're really saying is, I think you should do this. And I'll a lot of times put it back on them and say, well, when are you going to get started? And they're like, I'm not talking about me doing it. I think you should do that. We can all fall into that trap. And that's what was going on here. There were legalists who had taken the Sabbath and created it. It was really a gift to the church. It was a gift from God to his people. The Sabbath is a gift. Adam, I'm going to spend the whole day off with you. I'm going to spend this whole day with you. Every seventh day, I'm going to spend it with you. And we took that and we turned it into a bunch of rules and regulations about what could and couldn't be done on that day. And that's the battleground that's going on here. And the battle that's going on is between these group of guys who were... Don't you think it's weird that the Pharisees were in the grain field with Jesus? I mean, these guys are following him around. Any of you remember the movie Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kids? You have to be pretty old. You have to be like over 50 to get this. But Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid was a movie with Paul Newman and that handsome dude, Robert Redford. And they were Butch Cassidy and Sundance Kids. They were running from the law, and they every time they'd find a way out, they'd look over their shoulder and they'd say, like, who are these guys? Because they kept getting followed. Every time they thought they were getting away, and they finally came to a place where they were on a cliff, and the only way out was to jump off the cliff into the water. And, you know, they look over their shoulders and they're like, who are these guys? Grab a hold of a belt and jump over the cliff together. But the whole idea is Jesus and the disciples, well, not Jesus, the disciples must have felt like that a lot. Like, who are these Pharisees? Everywhere they go, they're following us. You remember Swarm? They're just gathering around. They're confrontive, and they're bold, and they're arrogant, and they think they know more than everybody else. Here they are with Jesus, the creator of the universe, and he's telling them things, and they're arguing with everything that he says. Because what they're looking for is they want to judge him and bring him down. They don't want to listen to him. He's the God of the universe, and they're not paying attention to what he says. And we can do that sometimes, too. We can be so self-absorbed by what we think is true, what we think is important, what we think is right, that we've got access through the Holy Spirit to God's heart, and we're not tapping into that. That's what I love about what Jim shares when he talks about deep roots. He's talking about tapping into something that's bigger than us, beyond us. And that's makes you look at the Pharisees and like, what are you guys thinking? You know, you're confronting Jesus. You're arguing with Jesus. And they weren't arguing because they wanted to learn from him. They were arguing because they thought they knew more than he knew. They were trying to trick him and trap him by their words and the power of their words. So, illegalists are crazy. I mean, I've known some in my time. I still know some. I'm scared of them. They're not comfortable to get close to because they're constantly trying to push their agenda on you and encourage you or force you to accomplish what they think needs to be done. But rarely will they do it themselves. And that's the way the Pharisees were. I mean, I doubt that they followed all the rules that they were prescribing to Jesus, that were pushing on Jesus. So the legalists used the Bible to empower their rules. In verse 3, Jesus replied, "Haven't you read the scriptures, what David said when he and his companions were hungry, when they went to the house of God and broke the law by eating the sacred loaves of bread that only the priest can eat?" This is a story that was out of 1 Samuel chapter 21. And Jesus, remember, Samuel was after David, and David was running from Saul, and he was all over the place trying to escape being killed by Saul, the king. And he went into the tabernacle because he and his men were hungry. They were on the run. They were on the road. They were hungry. And so they came to the priest and they said, "You know, we would like some food. Can you give us some food?" And the priest says, "The only food we have is the bread of the presence," which was 12 loaves of bread that were in the tabernacle as part of the ceremony. And every week on the Sabbath, they would replace those 12 loaves. And that's all we have. And it can only be given to priests. That was the law. That wasn't one of the Pharisees' laws. That was one of the laws of God. The priest said, though, if you can pass this test to show us that you're like us, we'll let you have the bread. Have you been with any women? And David had a law, or he had a rule, I should say, that none of his men could be with women during the time of battle. And so he, with confidence, said, "No, none of us have been with women." He said, "Well, then I'm going to give you the bread of the present. I'm going to give you the bread." And he gave them the bread. They took it out and had lunch. And that's the story that he's referring to here. And he's saying, what he's saying is, he wants to show them that their rules actually contradict what it says in the Old Testament. Their rules actually contradict what's biblically true. He's saying, basically, you guys have a lot of rules, but your rules sometimes don't agree with what the Bible says. So they had a huge power that was in their hands because they believed the word to be true, and then they pushed it a little further by developing all these rules. Like, they had, the Bible said, don't work on the Sabbath. But then they defined what work was going to look like. They defined how it was going to be played out. So they used the Bible to empower their rules, not the other way around. They took the Bible and created a whole life around it that was their life, not God's life. And then they defended it to the end. Legalists are often driven by a critical spirit. And you can see what it says through the last part of verse 6 on the Sabbath day, a man with the deformed right hand comes in the synagogue while he was teaching. And they were going to trap him. They were going to see if he would heal. I mean, look at the work that they're employing to try to trap Jesus. And all Jesus says to the guy is, "Raise up your right hand," and it's healed. That's the work that they're criticizing him. Just, they had the man raise up his right hand. That was all the work that he did. That was what they were accusing him of. So the Pharisees had a rule that had to do with work, that you couldn't provide medical care on the Sabbath. The only reason you could do it was if a baby was being born, if there was a traumatic accident or something like that. So you got to understand that religious people gain in strength and influence from the fear of man. That's how they get a lot of their influence, is by the fear of man. They like to make a public scene. They like to swarm. They're always looking for an audience. They're always looking for somebody that they can perform for. The religious people always tend to try to gather a crowd together and then make themselves look powerful in the midst of that crowd. So the Pharisees were, the Pharisees used the fear of man to create a snare. And you can see that in Proverbs 29, it says, Oh, that's just a reference. Proverbs 29, verse 25 talks about laying a snare because of the fear of man. And that's what the Pharisees were doing a lot of times. They created a snare for people because people were fearful of them. And the fear of man and a critical spirit were a big part of who they were and what they did. This whole idea of a critical spirit is something that we've heard a lot about. I mean, you could, anytime you're in a room with a bunch of people, there is somebody who will seem to emerge that's pretty negative and has maybe been hurt a little bit and they have a hard time playing with others, you know, and they just are real critical. And we are quick to throw that term critical spirit out. They have a critical spirit. But there really is a critical spirit or critical nature that comes, and there's reasons for that. And if you look at what a critical spirit is, there's this constant negativity. That's a big part of it. They create not just negativity in themselves, but they bring that negativity into an atmosphere, and they actually change the atmosphere in a room. They can change the atmosphere around other people. And the Pharisees were great at this. The Pharisees would come in, and immediately you know that we're being watched, we're being judged, there's a critical eye on us. Another thing that a critical spirit is part of what enables a critical spirit is insecurity. And if you look at people who have a critical spirit, a lot of times you'll find out that they were hurt or they were abused. Or they were betrayed. Betrayal's a tough thing to get past. It's hard to forgive betrayal. It's hard to forgive someone who's hurt you overtly. And a lot of people with a critical spirit, if you go back, they've been hurt by people. They've been let down by people. They've been discarded by people. They feel like they're not important anymore. So they're going to bring that importance into a room, and it tends to come across negatively. And a lot of times, what they just need to do is forgive. They just need to let go. And if you can create an atmosphere where forgiveness is available to them, you can often see people who have a critical spirit change overnight. Just from forgiveness, just from letting go. Forgiveness is a much more powerful tool than we realize. A lot of times, people with a critical spirit are just immature. They just don't know any better. If you look at the way the world operates, the fear of man and critical spirit are a big part of the way the world, especially the business world, works. We're being threatened, and we're threatening each other all the time with failure. We're threatening each other with making mistakes. You know, that's one of the things that the church really struggles with. It's in some ways, we don't allow for people to make mistakes. We don't allow for each other's faults. We don't allow for that. We don't make room for each other's faults. We tend to create structures that reprimand people. The structure actually reprimands people for making mistakes. And then, you know, what I'll hear is people come to me and say, how could you put that person in charge? How could you let that person lead worship? How could you let that person teach? And the reality is, I think there's a lot to be gained by giving people who aren't ready yet opportunities to do things that they feel called to do. You know, you may hear somebody prophesy and you think that's the most off-the-wall thing in the world to say what you just said, but rarely will somebody go up to that person and help them through that process of learning what it means. And it's just immaturity. They don't know. They're just trying to relay what God's saying to them. And so they'll prophesy and it'll be kind of off the wall and harsh and whatever, or like, I don't even think that's biblical. But, you know, instead of us going to that person and helping them through the process of maturing, a lot of times we'll just criticize them. We'll just be critical of them. Well, you know, we shoot our wounded kind of thing, you know. And yet that's kind of a joke and kind of passe, but we do that a lot. And I really want this place to be a place where you can learn and grow. Well, if you're going to learn and grow, then it's going to be messy and people are going to make mistakes. But more importantly than just, I'm not saying we should tolerate mistakes. We should not tolerate sin. But we shouldn't just stand back and criticize people either when they don't do things well. Especially if they don't know, if they're not mature. Now, it's a whole different thing if you have the maturity and you're just hurting people. That person should be stopped, yes. But again, you don't kick them out of the church. You try to, I mean, this should be a place where rehab is happening all the time for all of us. I love the, you know, the, what's that? That group that that meets, oh gosh, I'm slipping my mind, the recovery group. Celebrate Recovery. You know where that came from? Celebrate Recovery meets about four different places in town. They have a recovery group for people who are struggling with addictions. You know where that came from? Rick Warren developed Celebrate Recovery for his leaders in his church. That didn't really start out with recovery at all. It started out as a ministry. It started out as a tool that Rick Warren used on his leaders to try to help them recover from their hurt and pain and struggles they had in the future. Because he wanted leaders who were free, who were not in bondage. And so he created a tool, and it was so successful that he let other people use it too besides just leaders. And it became embraced by the recovery community as being a tool. But I don't think very many people really know that he used that to bring maturity to people, to bring recovery to people who are in leadership. We have to have an environment that helps people grow. I'm not saying that everything is in its right place here. I'm not saying that our hearts are pure in this whole thing. But we've got to try. We've got to try because we need every single person in this body. Nobody's expendable. Nobody is a throwaway here. We need everybody. If the changes happen that I think are going to happen in the next couple years, we're going to have a lot of people who come to Evangel because they're looking for a sanctuary and place to be restored and recovered. They're not coming here to listen to a sermon or listen to great music. That's not why they're going to come. They're going to come because the world is getting so crazy that they're looking for a refuge. And we're not very far off. You know, I've talked about this a lot. I go down to Portland a lot just to get a break, to grab a cup of coffee, study a little, and just enjoy being away from town. Kelly, which is my daughter Kelly, who I love, is here. She's got back from Iowa this week. We were down in Portland on Thursday going to a ceremony for my son-in-law, and we were driving around on bikes. We were riding around on bikes. We went on a pretty long bike ride. I don't know. I was probably in Portland a couple weeks ago the last time, and I'm probably there every couple weeks for a day, riding around. And when you ride on a bike, you see things that you don't typically see in a car. Thursday was amazing. There were more homeless people on the streets than I'd ever seen before. And they weren't typically down on Burnside like they are, or, you know, in the Pearl like they are down the lower ends. They weren't typically where they congregate, because there's homeless people everywhere in Portland. They were everywhere on all the streets. They were on all, I mean, something's going on in Portland right now. I don't know if it's because Mayor Potter has had some kind of confusing regulations that he's set up in the last couple months to deal with homelessness, but something radical is happening in Portland right now. The downtown area is filthy, and there's homeless people everywhere. And you know, in a downtown area, a lot of people walk back and forth to their businesses and the parking. There are more homeless people than there are people who are moving around the city. It's really weird. Something's going on, and it's going to change the city. I mean, the city's either going to respond to it, or they're going to lay down the law and remove it. I remember when we were doing ministry in Honduras, there was a lot of homelessness, a lot of crime, a lot of people on the streets, and we came down a couple years later, and it was literally no homeless people. None. Yeah, I know. We found out that they had actually physically removed and in some cases eliminated these people. They just removed them from the scene. And in a moral or a culture, moral culture like Honduras, you can do that. You can just eliminate people. If you have a problem, you just eliminate the problem. You don't mess with trying to rehab them and reform them. You just eliminate it. Something's going to happen in Portland. Watch the next couple months. Something's going to happen, and it's going to be an indicator of a shift. And I think if that happens in our nation, I mean, look what's happened recently. Hurricane Harvey, wildfires in the Northwest, Hurricane Irma, followed by Hurricane Jose. I mean, there is some traumatic stuff that's happening to our nation. As we speak right now, a hurricane is annihilating Florida. Catastrophic hurricane is annihilating Florida as we speak. a whole state is being turned upside down. Who knows how long that'll take them to recover? Much longer than it's going to take Harvey, the people at Harvey. And there's an outpouring. Red Leaf Coffee, I told you last week, took a truck. I think it was in the paper, too. Took a trailer down to the Gulf Coast to minister to those people with stuff in it. I mean, this, what's happening in Florida right now is so much worse than what's happening with Hurricane Harvey. And how many more of these can we take? How much more trauma can people in the United States take before they need support, need strength, need help? I mean, those are localized areas, but you know what it was like here when the fires were blowing everything from the east over the city, and for a week, everything was smoke. I mean, and then the wind shifted, and it slowed it down. But if the wind hadn't have shifted, it would have been in Troutdale. It would have been in Portland. Who knows? I mean, all it was wind, right? All it was a shift in the wind. So I think part of what we need to, and let's just go on to the end where we talk about what we would have learned. Part of what we would have learned is is applicable right now. We need to be ready for what God is doing. And these people, the followers of Jesus in this situation, would have seen some things and heard some things that would have really taught them an important lesson. One of the things is they would have seen that legalists and religionists were the only people that really Jesus confronted ever. He was so kind and compassionate to everyone else. But for whatever reason, these people he really kind of picked on. He didn't let them get away with anything. I mean, granted, they're in his face, pushing him, confronting him, belittling him, trying to make him slip up, trying to create a picture where he's the lawbreaker. But Jesus was rough on him. And he wasn't, I don't think he was rough on him because they were mean people. Or because they were, I think what was going on was Jesus had an agenda. Jesus was on his way to the cross. He knew what was about to happen. And he knew that he was about to show the world something they'd never seen before. They'd never seen this before. And that was grace. The Jewish world had never seen grace before. They didn't know what grace was. They didn't know how it worked. And these Pharisees, these legalists, were continually putting him in a position where they were his adversary, because if anything could kill grace, these people could kill it. If anything can kill grace, it's manipulation, it's legalism, it's making people follow the rules because they're your rules, and we're going to follow my rules because I made those rules up and it's my house, and we're going to do what I say because those are my rules. The church does not need that. Grace is a powerful thing in our hands. Rules are the opposite of that. They're the things that squish people's freedom and squish people's ability to grow and learn and be who God created them to be. We need to release people to be who God created them to be. And we don't need this place running rampant with sin. That's not what I'm saying. I'm talking about, I mean, we need to follow what the Bible says. We need to be true to what the Bible says. But developing rules outside of that just so we'll make ourselves comfortable or even make this place safe. All it takes is a couple people to come in off the street and disturb our meeting. And we kind of freak out a little bit. Instead of seeing that as an opportunity to embrace somebody and bring them in, we see that as an opportunity to keep the place clean and safe. And we got all kinds of reasons for that. I love the fact that we're down here because we're confronted with our heart every single time we come into this place. And I'll tell you, this place is going to be one of the busiest places in town soon. This place is going to be busy all the time because people are going to need a refuge. They're going to need a place to come in and talk to somebody and work through difficulties in their life. They're going to need a place to recover. And you're the people they're going to sit down with. It's not me. There's only one of me. There's lots of you, and you're going to be the people who are sitting with people at tables, helping them understand where does they go, how does they get there, and what. And I think that that's what these people would have seen here is that there's this. Jesus seems to have a message, and it is in it's being contradicted by the Pharisees, the legalists. And Jesus is not going to put up with that. He's so forceful, and at times you wonder, why was he so hard on these people, calling them snakes and vipers and whitewashed tombs? Why was he so hard? The reason he was hard is he had a message. He had an agenda, a message that was grace, and he wanted to make sure that message got out. We have a message, and the message is grace. The message is recovery. The message is freedom. The message isn't conformity. The message is you're free to be who God created you to be. Now let me help you become that person. Let me help you rise up. Instead of helping pushing you down and conforming you into a box and making you fit into the church, let me set you free to be whoever God created you to be. I mean, there's a John G. Lake out there somewhere who's ready to explode with healing. They may not look all that embraceable when they walk in the building that day, or maybe one of you in the room, maybe Don. I mean, this might be part of why God's healing him, is he's going to set him free to heal people. We may have to make room in our lives for people to get set free, people to get healed. So this is a time when we can prepare. This is a time when we're getting ready for what God's about to do. And I think that's what you can learn from this, is these people were watching and listening and learning what was happening with Jesus and through Jesus. We can vicariously do that through the scriptures right now, but the time is coming soon when we're going to have to do this. So I was sitting with Kelly, and we're at Zojo, and she said, so where are the invitation cards? Where do I get those? Because she was getting a cashier's check and started talking to this girl, and the girl was having a hard time in her life, and so she wanted to invite her to Evangel. And I said, you know, I can weasel my way out of almost anything. I said, well, I try to encourage people to actually bring people to church, not just hand them a card, but bring them to church. And she's like, oh, I plan on doing that. I'm going to put my phone number and say, text me when you get here and I'll sit with you. And I'm like, oh, geez. So we're sitting down there. I have my computer and I start making out the cards. Because she just got here this week, but she's already thinking about who can I bring and how can I get them here. And so now on the table out there, there's invitation cards. You can grab them, take them if you want, and you can hand them out to anybody you want. She actually rebuked me. She said, what's this whole thing about not wanting people to come to church, wanting the church to stay small? What? I listen to your teachings all the time. You say that a lot. Why do you say that? So things are changing. Things are changing. And that's just one person who comes in and shakes things up. She's got a lot of access to me, and I listen to what she says, so she has a big influence over my life. But things are changing, and they're going to change radically in the days ahead. I know I keep saying that, and you probably think, oh, yeah, he's just saying that again. But they are changing. Things are changing. Things in Portland are changing radically right now. Things in Longview will change. Longview doesn't suck. Longview doesn't suck. Oh, it's so far from sucking. Longview is an amazing place that is so primed and ready for a move of God. Yeah. Be careful. Be careful what you pray for right now. You know, those of you who are praying that God will teach you how to translate and go someplace else, be careful what you ask for. Those of you who are asking for a healing anointing, be careful what you ask for. Those of you who are willing to prophesy and say, Lord, I want to do that. I want to speak. Yeah, we're going to get together for a week in October, and it's going to be called A Week at His Feet. And we're going to remember the weeks of worship we did, a week of worship, where we had worship and art. We're going to have a week at His Feet, and it's going to be worship and art and prophecy. There'll be worship here every night. It's, I think, the 23rd through the 29th, something like that, in October. And we'll be here every night. And the reason why we're doing that is because somebody had sent me a personal prophecy that Larry Randolph gave me in 2002 or 3, something like that. It was actually in this room. I had forgot about it completely. Somebody sent me a copy of the recording of that prophecy that he gave me. And I was so impacted by it because I thought, we got to do more of this. This is so valuable to speak. Because since that time, some of the things that he prophesied have come to pass in my life. And I forgot about it completely, but all it did was reaffirm in my heart, we need to begin to speak more and more over each other's lives. A couple of weeks we did that. You know, we had all those people come up and just speak into each other's lives. I don't know what happened with Michael, Colleen, your son, but, I mean, he had two people speak into his life that day. Something had to happen. That you don't have that happen in a church you don't usually go to or never go to and not be impacted by it. And so a lot is changing, and you're in the very center of it. Nothing's going to happen without you as long as you stay connected. But it's really important to stay connected right now to each other. I'm not saying go to church more. I'm saying stay connected with each other. When there are the men's breakfast is not a it's not because we're hungry and we need a meal. There'll be food, but we need time together. We need time to grow in a relationship, and it's really hard to do because we're all really busy. But Saturday come at 9, and we'll eat together, and Dave Martin's going to be here from Emmanuel Lutheran Church. He's going to speak into our lives. He's going to prophesy into us. You know, and so come and tell your friends. Bring people who don't know Jesus to that breakfast. You know, bring little kids. Bring your sons. Bring little men. You know, it doesn't just have to be an old man thing. You know, 8 or 9? Does it say 8? Must be 8. Yeah. Kevin's right. I'm wrong. But we need that time together. So let's stand. I want to have you pray for each other. Pray that the Lord would get rid of every legalistic spirit and the spirit of criticism. No, that's not what we want to pray. We want to pray, and I just get in